I call him one of the world's greatest explorers, Robert Schock. And we're going to talk with him about many things happening on this planet, in this universe, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Robert Schock with us. Robert, how are you, my friend?
Very, very good. Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Of course, you're still at Boston U?
I'm still there. Yeah, Boston University.
You earned your PhD in geology, geophysics at Yale. You've been all over the map. Lots of things going on these days, Robert, huh?
Oh, absolutely.
My gosh. I want to talk with you a little bit about the sun. We'll get into Egypt. And you, of course, are the one who helped discover that something, that cavern at the base of the Sphinx that I want to talk with you about. But, you know, they're talking now that definitely there is going to be a magnetic pole shift with the sun. They said happens every year. Nothing too unusual about that. But I don't know. I just have a feeling this time we might get hit with one of those X flares. What are you feeling?
Yeah, I actually sort of have that sense too. Well, it happens every 11 years. There's a solar cycle, 11-year solar cycle. So every 11 years, the poles actually shift or reverse on the sun. And we're now in solar cycle 24, and we're getting up to the point where it should shift. But it's acting weird. That's sort of the colloquial way to say it. And it's not shifting right away. Some people have even suggested it looks like there may be sort of a double shift or a couple of little peaks rather than one big peak. And my interpretation, again, sort of speaking colloquially, is that the sun is it's very variable, and it seems to have a lot of, I don't know, it's almost like it can't make up its mind at this point. Thinking of it anthropomorphically.
Is that a danger to us?
I think it's a definite danger because it seems to be building up sort of internal stress, if you would, that internal equilibrium in not acting really smoothly. So again, thinking anthropomorphically, it's like it can have little hiccups, it can sort of sneeze, cough. And we actually saw this in May 2013, just a couple of months ago, where there were some major three X-class flares within 24 hours, then another one right after that. So within 2 days, four major, major X-class flares. Fortunately, they didn't have any, really major ramifications on Earth just because of the orientation. But if we have something like that again and a coronal mass ejection with it and it hits directly
right at us,
we could be in real trouble. As you and I have talked about before.
Well, you know, the grid is not insulated. They haven't done a thing, Robert, to fix that.
No, they haven't.
And I mean, this society now, we live with electronics. You know, we live with the ATM. We live with computers, smartphones, internets, communications back and forth. I mean, if those things went down, I think people would go nuts.
Oh, they would go absolutely nuts. People would go crazy. They wouldn't have access to their bank accounts. We would, it would be really bad. I hate to be a doomsayer, but it would be really bad because we could lose electrical grid systems, communications, even the most basic things, light and heat and pumping gas at a gas station.
Well, could you, and what would be worse? The power going down during a brutal winter where you could then your furnace won't work and you freeze to death, or in a brutal summer when you can't have air conditioning.
Well, they're both bad.
They're both bad. I would think, though, that we could survive a little better in the summer than we could the winter.
I would say that's probably true for the average healthy person. But, you also have a situation in cities. Think of a brutal summer where there's no air conditioning, no water.
Right. A lot of elderly.
Water can't be pumped. Water can't be purified in a major city. People can't get up and down in high rises in apartment buildings. Think of New York City. It's going to be bad either way if something like that happens. And I think a lot of it is the fear factor. So people can't communicate with each other. They can't communicate long distance at that point if electronics go down, if satellites go down, if basic cell phones go down, or we just have an infrastructure that's aging. It's based on electronics and electricity, and we are incredibly vulnerable at this point.
It's not if, it's when.
It is when, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, just like several months ago, we've always talked about asteroids and meteors, and we get that little one over Siberia that,
right,
you know, did injure 1,400 people.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, so we have always talked about, Robert, those possibilities. People laugh at us.
Exactly. You know, until it's too late.
Until it's too late. And, you know,
happens.
And I got to tell you, I don't want to be the one to be broadcasting to people saying, we told you so. But then again, who's going to be out there to listen if all the power goes down?
That's right. That's very much.
I mean, what a disaster.
What a disaster. And also, even people that have some kind of way to generate electricity, you know, have, you know, some kind of radio contact, you have to realize we're talking an electromagnetic phenomenon. It's going to affect even the basic radio waves going through the air, so to speak.
Well, and I've got to tell you, let me give you an example. You know, water. We take it for granted. You turn on your faucet and water comes shooting out, right?
Right.
And you think for a moment, hey, it's just pressure. It doesn't have any electricity. I don't have to worry about that. That's not true.
Not true at all.
The pumping plants are what pushes the water to you. And if those things go down, we're in a mess. But let me tell you, I think the biggest problem with all this, beyond the chaos and all that,
mm-hmm,
the meltdown of our nuclear power plants.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. Because we've seen that with Fukushima, just a very small case, I hate to say it that way. You know, one power plant that was, you know, look at the mess that we have there. And everything I've seen, it looks like they have downplayed how serious that is.
They sure have.
And if we have that around the world because of a major CME, major coronal mass ejection and X flares, I don't know what we're going to do.
Well, and here we go. The turn has become, the sun is changing. It was changing even before they talked about the pole shift.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's been acting very strangely for the last couple of decades. We've talked about this before. It is going into a period of, I think, incredible variability, extreme activity, highs and lows. So it's not a situation where you can say, oh, it's calming down and now nothing's going to happen. In fact, the last time we had a major, major coronal mass ejection, the 1859 Carrington event, it was during a relatively calm solar cycle. So you can't say, you know, oh, it's calmed down now for a few months, everything's fine.
Is there anything, well, there really isn't anything we can do, is there?
Oh, to stop it?
Yeah, we can't do anything. You can't stop Mother Nature.
You can't stop a tornado or a hurricane. The only thing we can do is be intelligent about it and try to plan ahead.
Well, and some people have, you know, we've talked about, you know, putting some storable things away, food,
right,
water, and things to last for a while. But
for a while, that's the key, but not, you know, if society has complete chaotic breakdown, how long can any individual last? And I'm very much an advocate that we have to sort of really work together on this and make collective plans and have networks of people cooperating versus the mentality of everyone's on their own and, you know, they've got their own little storage system of water and food that will only last you so long.
Absolutely. And then the chaos.
And the chaos, exactly.
And it's out there and you've got a problem. Now, if the X flare hits, does it merely affect the side of the planet that is facing the flare?
I have two answers to that question. From a natural history science perspective, no, because if it's big enough, it's going to go into the really the magnetic field of the Earth and spread all over the Earth. So it's going to spread around the Earth. And secondly, from a social perspective, we have so many integrated networks, global networks. If you knock out major power systems, communications, etc., in one part of the world, it has ramifications, as we know now. So I would say both from a social perspective and from a natural history science perspective, a major one will have global ramifications.
Robert Schock with us, author of Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. You know, we got hit with the Carrington event in the 1800s, took out the telegraph. What about way gone back, Robert? Any kind of proof that we got hit with a massive X-flare when we did not have electricity?
Yes, I think this is exactly what brought the last ice age to an end. You have a major, major climatic change, major heating, 9700 BC. We have isotope data and other data that indicates the sun was incredibly active at that time. And, you know, to make a long story short, we seem to be approaching that activity now in the present day, in the last couple of decades. But there is major variability in the sun over about a 10 to 15,000 year period, not just these 11-year solar cycle that we're used to in modern times.
There have been several people that we've had on the program who have warned Congress about these dangers, and still they fall on deaf ears, Robert.
Yeah, Congress, what can I say about Congress? Congress, I think, reflects much of society, which is a very short-term attitude. You don't worry about things until it's absolutely necessary to worry about them. And in that case, in this case, it may be too late.
May be too late. And if it is too late, then what? It's over.
Yeah, it's over. We have a reorganization of society, I suppose.
I bet most congressional leaders believe this, but nobody really knows what to do about it.
Right, exactly. And also most congressional leaders, if they're congresspeople, they're in there for 2 years. If they're senators, they're in there for 6 years. And they, again, think very, very short term. Next election cycle. They're not even talking about the next sun cycle
sure.
of 11 years. They're talking about the next election cycle of 2 years.
Well, you know, a lot of politicians will do things based on their own tenure. They don't look down the road. They don't try to fix things for the future. If
right.
they did, they would start working on the economy right now, tightening their belt, cutting expense, knowing that maybe one day, 10 or 20 years from now, we can actually have a balanced budget
right.
by you know, strategically cutting things every year. But they don't think about that because they don't want it to happen under their watch.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Exactly. And talk about the economy, getting back to solar flares. I mean, these are interrelated. Of course, it's going to affect the economy in many ways. And one way is much of our economy is electronic. More or less, the information is stored electronically. And if those records are damaged or devastated, wiped out, what's that going to do to our society? We're so economically based.
Indeed, indeed. We've talked with Robert Felix, one of our regular guests, Robert, who thinks we're in the beginning of a mini ice age.
That's not incompatible with the data. And that's not incompatible with major solar flares, because right now we could be going into a short-term lull. There's been things, for instance, in the past, the Maunder Minimum, which occurred in the 17th through early 19th centuries, where the sun was relatively quiescent. This affects climate and caused what was known as a mini ice age. That could happen again, but I want to point out very clearly, even if that happens, that doesn't preclude a major, major solar flare and coronal mass ejection occurring any time during it. Again, I think this has to do with the incredible turbulence and variability that we're seeing in the sun right now. So in a way, all guesses are off, except that we can expect something to happen.
Well, here we go.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting.
Sort of like a roller coaster.
It's going to be an interesting roller coaster indeed.
Exactly, because if you think of a classic roller coaster, you have sort of smooth sailing. Then when you least expect it, you're going up and down.
What's going on with your Easter Island episodes?
Oh, we were back in Easter Island. Katie, my wife and I were back in Easter Island this past November. It was wonderful to be back there. And this actually ties in because one of the things I learned while I was in Easter Island this last time was another tradition which I'd not heard before, which was told to me by one of the locals unsolicited. We were looking at some of the caves on Easter Island. They have all these caves, natural caves, and they were used in ancient times, and you can see clear evidence of that habitation. And he starts telling me about how on Easter Island, at one point in their remote history, they had to retreat to the caves and live there. He said 1,000 years, but you know, he meant a very long time, because conditions were so bad on the surface. And I immediately start thinking about, well, what could that mean, conditions bad on the surface? And I believe it tied in with a major solar outburst, just like we're talking about in ancient times.
What has been for you, Robert, the most fascinating place you've ever visited?
Oh, the most fascinating place? That's a really difficult question, because I love them all. Overall, Turkey. Yeah, we've talked about Göbekli Tepe. Yeah, and right now that is one of the most fascinating places, and not that far from Göbekli Tepe, the Cappadocia or Cappadocia area, where you have all the underground cities. It's just absolutely incredible. It's a fantastic landscape and a fantastic history of people going underground and building these huge cities underground that could hold thousands of people at a time and are so sophisticated and ancient.
Yeah, of course they did it by hand, right?
Of course.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. We just don't understand how they did this. They're incredibly sophisticated, multi-story, perfectly ventilated, etc. It is really a fascinating place.
We don't know, Robert, how they did anything.
No, we don't. We don't. But then you get to the Sphinx in Egypt, and I don't want to forget that. I still love Egypt, and you know, that's where I really started this journey personally, was in Egypt with the Sphinx. And how did they carve the Sphinx? How did they build the temples in front of the Sphinx with these blocks that weigh, you know, 10, 20, 30 tons apiece?
Well, we know how. Sound resonance, right?
Well, that's been suggested, but I think we ultimately don't have the absolute answer yet.
No. I want to spend some time when we come back from the break talking with you about Egypt. What's going on with Zahi Hawass? Where the heck is he?
Well, he is in private retirement, as they say at the moment.
It's like he's not in private jails.
Huh? Yeah. Well, I was told by one person when I was last in Egypt that he was enjoying himself. He was, in his private office, et cetera. I said, well, this sort of sounds like house arrest. Now, no one told me he was under house arrest. But I have heard that he wasn't allowed, at least at one point, to leave the country. And he has been, you know, had legal problems, but I don't know what the latest is on him. He seems to be making somewhat of a resurgence, which would not be surprising, because now that the military is in control, he was in good stead in the past with the military. So one never knows. He may come back to prominence.
Well, you never know. He just may.
You never know. It's a very, very volatile.
Hey, he was one of the greatest promotional people for Egypt they ever had.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. And that's one reason I think he could come back, because depending on how things go, they need that promotion.
Oh,
they need
absolutely.
Something positive.
He was good for tourism.
Yeah, he was great for tourism. And, you know, for all my ins and outs with him, I've always liked him. I'll put it this way. He was always fun to have dinner with.
Who paid? You or him?
What?
Who paid?
Oh, never him.
All right, Robert, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Edgar Casey once said that in the three places that the Hall of Records were located, Bimini, Central America, and at the foot of the Sphinx in an underground chamber, guess who found the underground chamber? We'll be back with Robert Schock in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. A couple little items here for you. First of all, our new Instagram link is now up. It's next to the icons, right-hand side of our navigation bar at the top of our homepage. So go ahead and play around with that. And also, as you know, on Fridays, we have our prayers list for those people who are afflicted with all kinds of ailments. So just simply send me your name of the person that you would want on that prayer list for Fridays. And also even a cat, Goatsy, is in need of prayer as well. And we pray for all those souls. So Goatsy is on the list, and do the best you can. Welcome back. Robert Schock with us. A number of books, including Forgotten Civilization. His website linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Robert, the great American prophet, Edgar Cayce, talked about the Hall of Records, that these incredible records of human origin scattered in three different regions. They went to Central America. They might have gone to Bimini, where the Atlanteans might have been. And, of course, they went to Egypt. He right. claims that at the base of the Sphinx, there is a tomb or a chamber, and these Hall of Records are in there. You were one of those who found a chamber there, weren't you?
Yes, yes. In fact, it was the two of us, Thomas DeBecky, a geophysicist I worked with, and myself. We found a chamber at the base of the Sphinx. It's actually under and in front of the left paw of the Sphinx. And I want to say very clearly, for those that don't know the story, we found this in the early 1990s. We were using seismic techniques, basically a sledgehammer on a steel plate, you know, to put energy waves, sound waves into the ground and penetrate deeply, much more deeply than you can penetrate with, for instance, ground penetrating radar. We found this chamber, and I knew who Edgar Cayce was. I did not honestly know about his prediction at the time. So it's not a situation where I was predisposed to finding this. I didn't actually know that he had made that specific prediction. But there we found it.
And I want you to go through the procedures on how you found this and how you even got out there to look for this.
Oh, this all started with my now good friend and colleague, John Anthony West.
Ah, yes.
Yes, yes. Many people, I'm sure, know who that is. He invited me in the 1980s to come to Egypt to look at the Sphinx, particularly to see if using geological techniques, the conventional dating of the Sphinx held up. The conventional dating at the time still is, I guess, the conventional dating, 2500 BC. And there were lots of indications, or he thought there were indications, that it could be older. He wanted me to evaluate this as a geologist. So I went out to look at that initially, and determined that, yes, in fact, there seemed to be evidence that the Sphinx goes back to a much earlier period, basically a pre-sand period, if you would, pre-Sahara Desert period, based on the erosion and weathering. But I wanted more data. I wanted not just surface data. I wanted subsurface geological data. So we decided to try to undertake seismic work to get subsurface data on weathering rates, that type of thing. So we eventually got permission after lots of bureaucratic struggling with the Egyptian government at the time. We did seismic testing around the Sphinx, and that's when we found that cavity, that chamber.
What do you think is in the chamber, Robert?
I honestly,
if anything,
don't know. Well, there is something in it. I'm convinced that there's something in it, because when we did the seismic work, it, the best way I can describe it in a colloquial sense is it gives a ringing sound that indicates it's not empty. So there are indications that something is in it. Now, what exactly, you know, we couldn't resolve at the time. It would really need to be investigated.
What would it take
directly?
What would it take to dig it up?
Oh, I think it would take quite a bit to dig it up. There's no indication on the surface right around the Sphinx of an entrance. So if you wanted to go directly into it, you would have to go through limestone bedrock. But what we did find is that the sand in front of the Sphinx, to the east of the Sphinx, this, for those that haven't been there, the Sphinx sits in a enclosure or hollow. It's, the body is actually carved down into the bedrock. In front of that is what's known as the Sphinx Temple, and in front of that is a big sort of sandy area. We did some seismic lines in that sandy area in front, directly east of the Sphinx, and what we found is that there's actually a cliff under the sand, And I suspect that the entrance to the chamber is in that cliff face or the tunnel that would go in. So if I were going to try to do it the right way, I'll put it that way, which would also entail quite a bit of time and expense, I would want to uncover that cliff first, remove the sand, and look for an entrance there.
When they built this chamber, and it was down, obviously, was it underground or was that ground level at the time?
No, that was underground when it was carved.
Okay, and then what did they do, cover it up?
Well, I think that they may have gone in through that cliff face, and since then it has filled in naturally with sand and debris.
Right, because the Sphinx at one time was almost, up to the neck, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It was up to the neck several times. So you're on the eastern edge of the Sahara Desert. The way the winds blow, the sand blows, et cetera, since it's been the Sahara Desert, the Sphinx fills up with sand. What's known as the Sphinx enclosure fills up with sand very, very quickly, within, 100 years or so, if left alone and not cleared out. The Sphinx temple in front of it gets covered with sand. At first, this was not even known that there was a temple there. When I say at first, for instance, when Napoleon's army came, they just saw the head of the Sphinx sticking out of the sand, and this cliff fills up with sand very, very quickly. So that would have to all be excavated, I believe. And also, it ties in with another important point. All of this goes back to pre-Sahara, pre-sand conditions. So initially, when they built it, I don't believe it was filling up with sand quickly because it was a very different climatic condition.
How close was Edgar Cayce in his trance-like state when he said there's a hall of records at the base of the Sphinx? Was he spot on?
Oh, he was basically spot on.
Oh.
Yeah. Huh. We found it under and in front of the left paw of the Sphinx. If I remember correctly, he talks about it being on their right side, but I think he's saying the same thing because he's thinking in terms of you're facing the Sphinx, you're looking at it, it's on the right side.
Was it Edgar Cayce's prediction?
Which would be the left paw, yeah.
Was it his prediction that got you to look for it?
No, never.
Okay.
Never. I didn't even know about his prediction. Like I said, I was actually looking for subsurface geological data to confirm the age of the Sphinx.
The fact, though, Robert, that you have now found something there, and now you know about Cayce's prophecy, which was done way before you found it.
Way before I was born.
What do you think about that?
Well, I somehow don't think it's just
it's not a coincidence. No,
it's just a coincidence.
They don't exist.
Yeah, and I still remember to this day, it really struck me. I was in my office at Boston University, and someone from the ARE, Association for Research and Enlightenment, the Edgar Cayce Foundation, called me in my office and told me what I had found. And as I just said, I didn't even know about Casey's specific prediction at that time. I knew who Edgar Cayce was. I wasn't that naive, but I did not know he had made this prediction and that we had found exactly where he predicted this chamber.
Did Zahi know about the Cayce prediction? I'm sure he did.
Oh, absolutely. Zahi is very well versed in Edgar Cayce information, should we say. He has had very strong ties with the Edgar Cayce Foundation for decades now. So he knew exactly.
All right, what about Zahi? Zahi ever plan to go in there?
Oh, he has denied that there's anything there.
He won't believe it.
He won't believe it. Well, this is at least his public persona.
How could he not believe it? I'm sure you showed him things, right?
I gave him all the data. And we published this in Geoarchaeology, a very good journal. I mean, this is no-nonsense stuff. But the way Zahi is, he puts on this public face. He denies things. If Zahi, of course, the regime has changed in Egypt, but if Zahi had been true to his typical form, he will deny things. He will say there's nothing to it. He'll try to let it die down, and then some years later, he himself will discover it. And I hate to put it so bluntly, but we've seen this in the past with Zahi.
Yeah. We
So
have.
I think that may be what he had planned, but of course we had a regime change in Egypt. Things have, other things have intervened. I'm hoping that we can get back there and that we can get into that chamber. A modern way to do it without doing all the excavation I was just describing would be to drill into it and put some kind of fiber optic camera in to at least image what is inside.
I want your imagination for a moment, Robert, to run wild.
Okay.
What might be in there?
Well, if Edgar Cayce is correct, it could be a hall of records. There could be a lot of information in there that actually...
Maybe the schematics of how they built the pyramids?
Maybe the schematics of how they built the pyramids. But I actually think it could be more important than that. So if you let my imagination run wild,
okay.
I think this may be a hall of records that goes back to the end of the last ice age. According to Edgar Cayce's prophecies, that's when it would go back to. He talked about, 10,000, 10,500 BC. We were talking about solar outbursts since then, and there was a major solar outburst that devastated the early civilizations. We've seen that at Göbekli Tepe. I think we're seeing that in Egypt now. The pre-dynastic, the before-dynastic Egypt, thousands of years earlier. And maybe there are records of exactly what happened during that last major, major solar cycle that could be useful to us in the present day.
I think if Cayce was correct about many of the things he has done, and I'm a staunch believer in Edgar
Cayce. Oh, he was. He had an incredible track record.
I would think that there was an Atlantis, in that as it was sinking, they took off in various areas. One went to, a group went to Central America. A group went, here to the Bimini area. And a group went to Egypt.
Right. And I think that all the indications are, if we are going to talk in these terms, that they were very sophisticated, what we would in modern times call scientifically knowledgeable, and they would have kept records of exactly what was happening and recorded that. And so maybe those records are in that chamber.
What if they also say, now I'm going to let my mind wander for a bit, what if they also, much like the work of the late Zechariah Sitchin, pointed out extraterrestrial visitation, maybe the Anunnaki, like they have in Samaria? Maybe they have all kinds of information about things. Maybe there's a craft down there. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Exactly. Who knows? And if not a full craft, maybe some kind of plans or schematics or, again, information about it.
We've got to go down there.
Oh, I agree. And not only do we have to go down there because of the information that may be there, but there's also a time crunch right now because the water table is rising and there's a very good chance that it's already beginning to be flooded, that chamber. And
oh,
this
boy.
Is a modern phenomenon. It has to do with several different factors. One is the dams along the Nile, which are changing the water table. And also, this is on the outskirts of Cairo. And Cairo is a huge city with tens of millions of people. A quarter of the population of Egypt essentially lives in Cairo. So because of sewage and waste, that type of thing, it's changing the water table. And so there's a really, really good chance, I hate to say, that this chamber is going to become totally flooded and things could be damaged inside. So there's even more.
So we're going to lose all this great historical.
Well, we don't know how it's recorded. Maybe they recorded it somehow that would withstand, being flooded. But we don't know. I wouldn't want to take the chance that's on parchments or that type of thing. And we go in there and we find that, there was all this great information, but it's unrecoverable now. That would be, because we waited too long.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
Yeah, so I think, it's imperative we get into it sooner than later.
What about the other Hall of Records, the other two areas? I mean, I wonder where they could actually be.
Yeah, I think we have a really good fix on Egypt and where it is. The other two, to the best of my knowledge, and I'm not an expert on the other two, we really don't know exactly where they are. That, to the best of my knowledge, no one's identified an actual chamber or cavity or place you know, specifically where they are, just the general locations, as Edgar Cayce suggested.
What an exciting moment, Robert, when they ever go down there, if they do.
Oh, I hope. I'm hoping. You know,
we need a new administration there.
Yeah, I'm the sort of the optimist here that with the new administration, once things settle out in Egypt, because it's, you know, incredible turmoil at this moment, and it could devolve into a civil war. I hate to say that. I hope it doesn't. I really hope it doesn't, of course. But once things settle down, maybe in a year or so, I really hope that with the new administration, we can get permission and
What would it cost to drill that out?
Oh, you know, in the scheme of things, we're not talking huge amounts of money. You could probably do it for a few tens of thousands.
Oh, my gosh, it's well worth
it. Yeah.
Especially with the records down there.
Yeah, exactly. At least to get into a drill down and put something down just to see what's there.
Well, the reason why I believe there's something there, Robert, is because, again, back to Edgar Cayce, I mean, if the guy predicted there was a hall there, who would know that?
Yeah, and, exactly.
You know, so you got to assume everything he said was correct.
Yeah, and it's so accurate. And I know you know, but I don't know if everyone knows, he did a lot of other types of predictions. He would diagnose people with illnesses and was incredibly accurate. So he did a lot more than just predict where halls of records were.
It's amazing times.
Yeah.
Let's have some fun. And let's do it. A couple minutes ago before we take some phone calls with you, Robert. What's new? I know you travel a lot in terms of events and speaking engagements. You got a whole list of places to go, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Things that are coming up. I'll be in Austin in September, and I encourage people. That's, I think, the last weekend in September. I encourage people to come. I'm doing a one-on-one workshop for the weekend if people would like to get together with me. It will be a really nice opportunity. There's information about that on my website. Can I say that?
You sure can.
Yeah, www.robertschock, robertschock.com. Because we want to make sure that people know how to spell my last name if they don't, S-C-H-O-C-H. And that'll be a solo event with just me for the weekend in Austin. Then there's a big Paradigm Symposium in Minnesota coming up in October.
That's a good one. You're going to like that.
Yeah, that'll be very interesting. I think I'm going to enjoy that a lot, and I'll be there with a number of other speakers. And then something very fun that I've organized with a couple of colleagues and friends, David Hatcher Childress and Hugh Newman of Megalithomania. We're doing a little cruise in January to see the Mayan ruins in Tulum. And people are invited to come to that. It'll be just a good time and have a lot of fun. You'll be able to talk and relax on the boat while traveling there.
What's the single greatest mystery on this planet? The pyramids?
I think we were just talking about maybe the Hall of Records.
Yeah, well, that's all tied in.
Yeah, the Sphinx and pyramids. And really, I think that goes back to the ultimate mystery of what happened at the end of the last ice age. You know, Plato's dating of Atlantis is exactly the modern dating of the end of the last ice age.
All right, stay with us. Robert Schock, our special guest, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com, his latest work, Forgotten Civilization, the Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. And mark my word, one day we're going to get hit with an X flare. Let's hope it's a little one, not a big one, but it's going to happen. Sooner than later, I'm afraid. We're going to come back. We'll take your calls. X-Flares, Pyramids, Hall of Records, you name it. We've got it. One of the greatest explorers of all times, Robert Schock, with us right here on Coast to Coast AM.